This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments podcast for the week of October the 13th, 2014. This podcast is brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs. Any use of this audio for this podcast without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated and your state society of CPAs is prohibited. The podcast is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Let's go ahead and take a look at what's been happening in the past week with regard to federal tax developments. It's a quieter week generally in terms of things emanating from the IRS just because we're now past the end of the federal government's fiscal year. But there was one significant development that came out this week that's probably related to the fact that we were approaching the October 15th deadline, and the IRS preferred for this guidance to become widely known after that deadline finished up rather than before, because it's going to change some issues for filing that the service does not really want changed until next year, even though this retroactively basically will give individuals kind of a no problem, don't worry about it, if they had failed to report properly in the past, or at least for many of them. And the issue in this question is Revenue Procedure 2014-55, which was issued this week, and it deals with various holders of Canadian pensions. The issue that comes into play is there are various things. Canadian pension systems, similar to U.S. pension systems, provide for deferrals of taxation under Canadian tax law if you're in the pension systems there. The hitch is, of course, these are not qualified plans under United States tax law. For obvious reasons, they're not going to comply with all the standard rules in the 400 series. So by default, these entities become foreign trusts, and foreign trusts that essentially would have income taxable to the owner of the rights in the trust, meaning that on paper, if an individual who is either a U.S. is a resident or a citizen of the United States that has an interest in a Canadian pension, would end up having to report that income currently by default. Under the treaty with Canada and the convention, we have an option for individuals to basically conform their reporting in the U.S. to the reporting in Canada, basically, and treat a Canadian pension much like you would a U.S. pension. There would be no tax during the years you received. During the years, income is building up inside the plan. There's no tax being paid currently. And when you take distributions, you will then pay tax on the distribution. This has the advantage of matching income and expenses, shall we say, income and taxes. Because if you're paying taxes currently as the balances build up in these plans in Canada, you're paying U.S. tax today, you're going to pay Canadian tax years later when you take the money out. Well, that's not going to work very well for a U.S. foreign tax credit for the obvious reason that in the year you finally pay the Canadian tax, you pay the U.S. tax or the Canadian tax, there is no U.S. tax being imposed. Traditionally, what had happened, we had had with the convention, you could elect a deferral option. Now, this required technically an election. And a number of years ago, the IRS issued Form 8891 that covered a couple of issues. It allowed individuals to essentially be able to make the election to pick up their, to defer the income, and also handled the issues of reporting on a foreign trust. The problem, of course, is that individuals who didn't understand that they need to file this form never made the election to defer income, and the default treatment theoretically is these individuals had to pay tax currently. The only fix if you did not make a timely election by filing Form 8891 was to go back and get a private letter ruling. Under Revenue Procedure 2014-55, the IRS is going to provide generally for individuals if they have been essentially not reporting the income on Canadian pensions, and, oh yeah, they never did make the election. If a person has never reported the income, this is going to retroactively, back to when the rules came in, the election option of the convention back in 96, this is going to retroactively make those elections, treat them as if they had made the elections and they had filed this form for each of the years in question, basically providing relief. It will not, however, provide relief if an individual maybe who had discovered this failure to elect and decided not to go for private letter ruling and was actually reporting income currently, those individuals will still have to go now seek a private letter ruling because now they're going to be changing their method. The big hit from this, if you have individuals with these pension plans, is you will no longer be filing Form 8891 starting for your 2014 returns. This is the reason why the service most likely brought it out late, because they didn't want people getting confused. In fact, the ruling makes it very clear. If you're still filing a 14 return, you really should file the 8891. That will cover your foreign reporting requirements. And you'll be able to note when we have the FACTA reporting that you filed the proper form. We should also note that this retroactive, the simplified reporting does not cover issues regarding FBAR reporting or the FACTA issues. That'll be clarified going forward for future years. All this is going to solve for you is this new simplified system will get rid of the 8891 and what it did. We have a few other developments this week that are of interest. There's a continuing saga that's going on between the IRS and the office of Senator Barbara Boxer. This is IRS's new, their new and most recent information letter to the senator. This particular information letter that came out this week on June 20th ended up bringing out a brand new letter where the senator, we've had a continuing option going from information letter 2013-0036 earlier this year, and now a new follow-up letter that was issued here on the 20th of September that came out and dealt with this issue. So what's happened is IRS had misinterpreted California's short sale anti-deficiency rule for trustee sales. If you've been following that, the IRS had indicated that would always indicated in a letter issued late last year that this would always create a basically non-recourse debt. Reality is it doesn't. A lot of people notice when they put that letter out that, wait, that's totally at odds with what we understood of the law before that point. Around April 15th, the IRS issued a follow-up letter to Senator Boxer indicating, well, yeah, we probably misspoke, we've been told. Senator Boxer wrote back and said, well, what about people that relied on the letter? Now we have some more guidance. The big takeaway from this one is that the IRS basically comes out, and one of the final things they say in this new letter, which points out, well, you can't rely on these letters, and basically, yeah, it's complicated, and we're not sure it really works. They did say that due to the fact this is a complicated area, the service is now considering issuing guidance. If you have taxpayers who lost residences in a state that has an anti-deficiency statute, even one where you concluded that the anti-deficiency statute was not effective in converting the debt to total non-recourse due to options lenders had to pursue other collection avenues rather than going the route that created, let's say, they can't collect the rest of it, you may want to keep an eye out for this future guidance. It is possible the IRS may issue some options that could allow us to go back and treat some of those as if they were not, as if they were true non-recourse debts and part of the sales proceeds. That could, in some cases, lead to refund opportunities, but all this is dependent on the IRS actually issuing guidance that would follow up on this letter sender Boxer. So if you are in a state that has that sort of option, and there are a number, especially in the western U.S. states that have anti-deficiency statutes of various sorts, you may want to keep your eyes on it. This can expand and is true even in states like Arizona, California, that have anti-deficiency statutes that in some cases do provide and convert debts to non-recourse. They also tend to have other variants of the statute that will make other debts only non-recourse in a non-judicial foreclosure. Those states may specifically be impacted by whatever guidance the IRS brings forward, so keep your eyes open in that area. Private Letter Link 2014-41006 is interesting because what it told us was some information about how the IRS handles 83B elections. And it reminds us of Revenue Procedure 2006-31. The catch is, of course, if you receive a restricted property for services, Section 83B provides generally you don't pay tax until the restrictions lapse. However, if you elect under 83B to ignore the restrictions, you pay tax on the transfer immediately. The reason you may do that is because you expect the property to appreciate and you don't want to wait until 5 years down the line and pay much more tax at ordinary income rates. You'd prefer to, most often this is stock, have that asset start counting today as a capital asset, and then 5 years down the line when you fulfill all the requirements and the restrictions lapse, then you could sell it, get capital gains. But the downside of that is if you don't fulfill a commitment, there is no loss on the disposition. So there's a risk to 83B. In this case, the taxpayer had made an 83B election, which has to be made within 30 days after receiving the property, Within that same 30-day period, he decided he wanted out. He filed for a private letter ruling. Under Revenue Procedure 2006-31, if you file during that time period, you can actually get the 83B election reversed. The IRS will reverse in that period if you file for a PLR. The takeaway from this for those of you in practice is if you do get a taxpayer who made the election without consulting you, and it turns out after talking with you about the risk decides it was a bad idea and you're within the 30-day window, you can get it reversed, but you've got a very short time frame to file the private letter ruling request. You want to note and take a look at Revenue Procedure 2006-31 and this particular private letter ruling to take a look at the various issues that are involved and understand what your client may need you to do to make sure they don't have problems going forward and make sure they actually get this reversed. In the case of Applied Research Associates and Affiliate versus Commissioner, 143 Tax Court Number 17, published decision that dealt with a unique problem. This is a case of a consolidated corporate return. What happens if some but not all the members of the consolidated groups are qualified personal service corporations? How do we handle that? Do we have to pay the, remember, qualified personal service corporations and C-Corps do not get the benefit of lower tax brackets. Non-qualified, you know, other corporations do get those lower brackets, which start at 15%. Now, in this case, we had an engineering firm which had taxable income, and the other entity in the affiliated group was a ranch. And yes, this is an engineer rancher, and yes, he really did both. And the ranch lost money. The IRS was seeking to apply the standard across-the-board top corporate rate to the consolidated income, stating that you had to separately test. The IRS and taxpayer agreed. The engineering firm, if tested by itself, was a personal service corp. The ranch was not. And if you, the proper testing was to combine all entities in the consolidated return, that would also fail the qualified personal service corporation test, which, by the way, is probably going to be true if you ever have a real operating company out that is not a personal service corp that's in a consolidated group. The IRS argued you had to separately test each corporation. The tax court disagreed, holding that the IRS regulations under consolidated returns make no mention of having to separate this test out. The IRS has been aware of this issue for 25 years, never clarified it. Those regulations clarify other issues. So the tax court held for today, we go ahead and this entity gets the lower brackets. Obviously, if you read the decision, the downside of this is it tells the IRS, well, if you got a problem with this, change the regs. We'll see if the IRS responds to that. But if you do have a personal service corporation that has other affiliated companies and files a consolidated return, you may have a refund opportunity here if that entity has paid tax at the top corporate rates. It may also open up certain planning opportunities depending upon the nature of what's going on. By the way, the tax court specifically mentioned they understand this could be used in ways maybe the service won't be happy with, but they said we've got to follow the law. In Technical Advice Memorandum 2014-41021, the IRS, we have a discussion there showing about reasonable cause. Now, this deals with a private operating foundation, the excess holdings and investments, but the real interesting issue here is how the taxpayer failed to show reasonable cause for reliance on the advice of a professional. It outlines the very detailed requirements to be for a taxpayer to escape a penalty. In this case, this is the 10% tax and has a reasonable cause per component. The IRS outlines in there that you have to show that you asked for advice on the issue from a professional, you provided the professional with all relevant information, and you basically got bum advice. The problem in this case was that the taxpayer claimed they had they basically had engaged an attorney, but they did not provide as part of their request for relief information on what they told the attorney, nor information on what the attorney told them back in detail to show that they had truly relied upon it in this situation. If you're going to go for reasonable cause based on reliance on a professional, your client needs to be ready to turn over that type of information. They may or may not like turning that information over because it may end up opening up other issues. Next thing, couple of quick things here. The case of Ringo versus Commissioner, 143 TC number 15. This was is interesting because the IRS, it was a whistleblower case. The IRS had issued a letter denying the whistleblower claim to the taxpayer. Under the rules for whistleblower claims, you have 30 days to file in the tax court after receiving a determination that you're not qualified for the tax court to review that determination the IRS made. 7 months later, the IRS wrote back to the taxpayer saying, well, it turns out that first letter was an error, and we're still considering your claim. The IRS told the tax court, well, you don't have jurisdiction because we haven't really issued a final determination. The tax court ruled in this case, sorry, once you issue a determination, even if that determination is an error, and the court goes back and points out the same rule applies if we're dealing with regular tax assessment issues, once the jurisdiction of the court is invoked, the IRS can't get rid of that jurisdiction basically by doing anything effectively short of going in and basically conceding the whole issue. If there's anything left to be tried and the parties don't agree to settle the case, then the tax court continues to hold jurisdiction. In this case, Ringo wants to move forward at the tax court level to get a judgment on this, and the tax court said, you know what? Ringo has a right to have this looked over. We also have here a couple of other issues here. Notice 2014-58. The IRS has amplified and clarified the economic substance rules. In this notice, which is drawn retroactively back to when the codified economic substance rules came in place in 2010, it basically clarifies the definition of transaction, of the definition of a transaction, and also the rule of similar rule of law. Under the transaction test, the rule makes clear that the IRS can take a look at the various steps involved in whatever program you have, and based on facts and circumstances, can either combine or separate different parts. Because remember, the penalty under these rules applies to any transaction that lacked economic substance. That allows the IRS to slice and dice whatever was part of the plan to find transactions to separate out and have those transactions, therefore, trigger the extra penalty. Also, the tax applies if you fail the economic substance test, the one defined in the code, or you fail under similar rules of law. The IRS gives us a definition of similar rules of law here as well. Make it very clear that the sham transaction doctrine is a similar rule of law if you lose based on a judicial sham transaction doctrine. But also states the IRS will not pursue a similar rule of law claim unless they are also asserting that there is an economic substance claim at the same time. Now be careful how you read that, because the way I read it, the IRS may assert that you fail under the statutory rule, but as long as they made that assertion, if the court then determines that you really fail under sham transaction, you're still going to owe the penalty. In essence, they asserted the other one. Once they assert the other one, you're basically on notice that they plan to assert the tax. Also, one interesting thing, if you deal with taxpayers who are green card holders, and we talked about a green card case a week ago, information letter 2014-0033, it is an interesting letter to read because it has a lot of details about the proper tax treatment of green card holders. As you remember, last week we discussed the problem of a taxpayer who thought they had informally abandoned permanent legal resident status, and the tax court held they hadn't. This information letter is good to walk through with any individuals that have that status to go through the various steps of how you acquire the status, how you measure the first year you're in, what happens if you have, in fact, if you're a permanent legal resident of the U.S., but also deemed to be a resident or taxable by another country, takes a look at the tiebreaker mechanisms, discusses those, and also discusses how you end up getting rid of the status. So if you have clients who have that information letter, very useful, as we know from the letters with Senator Boxer. Obviously, information letters cannot be fully relied upon, but it does give you a pretty good outline of how the system works. This has been the Tax Update for the week of October the 13th, 2014. Be sure to check back with us next week for further developments in the coming week.